dream.
How many of you saw the movie Princess Bride? All right. So it's true today. Marriage is what brings us together today. Now, if this is your first time with us, we want to welcome you. I'm very excited that you chose to worship with us this morning, and we've got a packed house here. And anyway, if you have questions about the church and you need to get those questions answered, we have an information desk out in the commons on the west end. And there's a lot of friendly people that can answer your questions about what a Fellowship Greenville is. And if you've been here for a while and you want to jump in and volunteer and serve in our church, and we need lots of people serving, we have hundreds of people serving on a Sunday morning, but you can visit our Next Step table out in the East End. Or if you're not in a small group, a community group, a men's, women's group, you want to get plugged in, that's the place to go. Next Steps tables. Mowage. All right. So anyway, one of the other things that we want you to know, if this is your first time here, is that we're usually preaching through whole books of the Bible. We went through Exodus last year. We're going to start Romans in the fall. But this summer, we're doing a topical series on gospel fluency. You say, well, what's gospel fluency? Well, gospel fluency is being able to easily and articulately communicate the good news about Jesus to yourself and others. It's understanding the gospel so well that you can speak it to yourself and to other people's lives, into every part of life, making gospel connections into every part of life, every day and in every way. And in this series, we've basically been asking a question each week and answering it, and that is, how does the gospel help us think about blank? And we've talked about how the gospel helps us think about culture, how the gospel helps us think about identity, how the gospel helps us think about anger and worry and pride. And this morning we're going to talk about how the gospel helps us think about marriage. All right. So now I realize we got a lot of married people in here, but I also know that we got a lot of unmarried people. We got a lot of singles here. And I'm really, really glad you're here this morning, because what we're going to talk about is something I wish I knew when I first got married, and I went through premarital counseling and all that, but I'm going to share with you some things that is applicable to both married and singles today. And by the way, next week we're actually going to talk about how the gospel speaks to the issue of singleness. And married people, you need to be here, because you're going to have the opportunity at somewhere along the line, you're going to have a friend, and you're going to be able to be a friend and speak gospel into someone's life regarding the issue of them being single, maybe wrestling with that. So how does the gospel help us think about marriage? Now, each week here, the last few weeks, I've started with a confession. Now, I'm not going to do that this morning, but I'm going to announce a celebration, and that is July 23rd today. Karen and I have been married for 40 years. So this is our 40-year anniversary. And so I'm very excited about that. And, you know, 40 years is a long time. Yeah, there's the picture there. I'm digging the mustache, aren't you? That's actually on a tin type. But anyway, see, if you're young, you don't even know what that is. So anyway, 40 years is a long time. And I wouldn't want you to think that I think that just because I've been married for 40 years that I'm some kind of expert on the subject, because I'm still very much a work in progress. I struggle with the same kinds of things that you do. And I've made lots and lots of mistakes, and Karen can testify to that, but I've received lots of grace. And it's only by the grace of God and the grace of Karen that we're married after 40 years. And this is an important topic, and so let's just go ahead and jump in. Now, you know, I'm hesitant to mention many movies in sermons and messages because, well, I mean, there's always something good about a movie, and there's always something that's not so good about movies. And I don't want you to think that necessarily I'm endorsing a movie. But how many of you saw the movie Juno? The movie Juno. Okay, how many of you didn't see the movie? Okay, so I'm going to spoil it. I'm going to ruin it for you this morning in case you ever want to watch it. No, I'm not going to do that. But let me just, if you're younger, you no doubt saw this, because it's a movie about 8 or 9 years old. But the movie's about a teenage girl named Juno, and she lives with her father and her stepmother, and they live in kind of a kind of a rundown middle-class neighborhood, and she ends up getting pregnant, and she struggles and wrestles with what she's going to do about the pregnancy, and she goes to an abortion clinic and decides that she doesn't want to go that route, and so she decides to have the baby and put the baby up for adoption. So she meets a prospective couple, and as she talks to them, she finds out that they have marriage troubles, and so she's confused because, you know, her relationship with her kind of sort of boyfriend is a disaster. Her dad, you know, and mom are divorced, and that marriage was a disaster. And now she's looking at this couple who want to adopt her child, possibly, and that marriage is a disaster. And so there's this very tender moment in the movie where she's talking with her dad, and in the movie her dad is great. He's wonderful. Like when she comes and tells him that she's pregnant, he's kind and he's compassionate, understanding, and helpful. But she asked her dad a question I think is very profound, and I think it's a question that just about everybody in our culture asks at some point or another, because it's a question that lays on the surface of our culture, and she basically kind of says it two ways. She says two things. She says this: I wonder, Dad, sometimes if people ever stay together for good, like people in love. And then she says it this way: Dad, I just need to know that it's possible for two people to stay happy together forever. You hear there's a question in that. I just need to know, is it possible for two people to stay happy together forever? In other words, Dad, I've looked around. I'm looking around at my world, and you know, it didn't work out for you and Mom, and you know, it's not working out for me, it's not working out for this couple who wants to adopt my baby. I'm looking around, and I want to know, am I kidding myself? I mean, am I shooting for something that's just impossible? Because it is easy to fall in love. It's much more difficult to stay in love. And the question is it possible for two people to stay in love for life? And again, I think everybody at some point or another asked that question. We ask that question in spite of what we see in the culture. We ask that question in spite of what we might have seen growing up. In spite of what you might be currently experiencing in your marriage, what you might have experienced in a previous marriage, in spite of the divorce rate in our country today, I think all of us want to know, is it possible for two people to stay together and stay in love for life? And we want to believe that it's possible, or we would never get married, right? I mean, we all want to believe that, in spite of how bad things might have been for you, in spite of how bad things might be in our culture. Most of us think and hope and pray and believe that somehow, some way, that we'll find a person that we can grow old with. Might be in a nursing home, you know, both of you are in walkers and you're going down the hallway to the dining room for supper, and you sit down and you hold hands at supper, and your hands are shaking, you know, and people look at you and they go, look at them, look how old they are, and they're still in love. I mean, isn't excuse me, isn't that what we want? We want a lifetime love. Now, I why I think that is. I think it's and I don't have a verse on this, but it's a little bit of the image of God in you, and a little bit of the image of God in me, because God loves us with a lifelong, eternal, everlasting love. There's nothing that can happen that will separate us from God's love. We're always in His love, and because we have that love from Him that's eternal and everlasting, we have that same desire in us because we're made just in the image of God. So we're looking for what God has given to us. Now, I need to talk about falling in love for about 10 seconds because that's all it takes. It's about 10 seconds. And you know, it's easy to fall in love. I mean, there's like 1,500, I mean, if you have a pulse, you can fall in love, right? I mean, there's like 1,500 matchmaking services in the country today, and, you know, I've met people that have met that way, and they have good marriages, and so I'm not knocking that, but in some ways today, it's never been easier to fall in love, but I think you would agree with me that it's never been harder to stay in love, and that's what I want to look at. Now, there are several reasons why it's hard to stay in love, and these aren't new. I mean, Karen and I spoke for about 15 years for Family Life's Weekend to Remember Marriage conferences, and we talked a lot about these things, and I've got several old sermon series by my friend Andy Stanley from years and years ago that he did, and I've listened to those over and over and over, and I'm going to incorporate some of the insights and illustrations in my message today from him. So this is not new information, but there's three reasons that, and there's more than that, I understand, but there's three reasons why I think it's difficult to stay in love for life, all right? So the first is, it's difficult to stay in love because of what we saw or we didn't see growing up, because very few people today grew up in a home where they saw a healthy marriage relationship modeled for them. Very few people grew up in a home where they saw a healthy marriage relationship modeled for them. And since we haven't seen one, we don't know what it's really all about. And so what happens is, because we haven't seen one, we unknowingly absorbed a lot of wrong-headed, unwritten rules for relationships that became ingrained in us as functional beliefs. And we talked about functional beliefs last week, so you can go back and look that up. But basically, these are functional beliefs. We all know that Jesus said, do unto others as you would have them do to you. But our functional beliefs are more like, do unto others like they do to you. Do unto others before they do to you. Do unto others when you feel like it. Do unto others to get them to see things your way. Do unto others to get them to do things your way, to get your way. Do unto others to get them to do for you, right? I mean, so these are the unwritten rules of relationship that a lot of us have absorbed and they become ingrained in us, but those rules ruin relationships and they short-circuit staying in love. Now, so it's not just what we saw modeled for us or didn't see modeled for us when we grew up. It's how we felt when we were growing up. So second, it's difficult to stay in love because very few people today grew up in a home where they felt the kind of love and acceptance needed to lay the foundation for a healthy marriage relationship. Now, I want you to hear me and hear me good here. I grew up in a really good Christian home. I had a mother and father that loved me, and so this isn't about blame. I'm not bashing good Christian homes or anything like that. But what I'm saying is that all of us grew up in families made up of broken people. Broken people, many of them trying to do the best they could, but everybody trying to get their needs met. And so, none of our parents, none of us can give and receive the kind of love that God wants us to give and receive. We can't do that 100%, so we come in with somewhat of a deficit. And, I tell you, if you read books from the experts, you know, like sociologists and child behavior experts and relationship experts, I mean, they have like this list, and I mean, this is really an overwhelming list, because they tell us what it takes for a child to grow up into adolescence and then into adulthood to be fully equipped to engage in healthy relationships. And so this is all it takes, okay? This is all it takes. You need to grow up in a home where you get massive doses of respect, encouragement, comfort, security, support, acceptance, approval, appreciation, attention, and affection. That's all you need. That's all you need. Just you get massive dose. That sounds like the home you grew up in, right? I mean, growing up, all you need is massive doses of respect, encouragement, comfort, security, support, acceptance, approval, appreciation, attention, and affection. I mean, if that's what it takes to equip us to engage in long-term relationships as an adult, I mean, if that's what I needed to feel growing up, I mean, what are the odds of any of us being able to have a happily ever after kind of relationship, especially when we enter a relationship with someone who they didn't get it either? And so what happens is we come into adulthood and we're looking for someone that we can get respect and encouragement and comfort and security, support, acceptance, approval, appreciation, attention, and affection. So I fall in love with Kara. Kara falls in love with me, and we're in love with each other. And then, you know, after a while, I'm wondering, now, can you give me respect, encouragement, comfort, security, support, acceptance, approval, appreciation, attention, and affection, or are you just cute? And so what happens is, you know, what starts out as a hug around the neck becomes a stranglehold, because everybody's trying to squeeze all those things out of each other. And because I got to have it, because I came in with a deficit, and I'm going to squeeze it out of you, and you're going to squeeze it out of me. You see, what makes marriage, what makes staying in love so difficult is because what we seen and what we didn't see, what we felt, what we didn't feel, and both those things lead to a third reason that marriage is so difficult to stay in love for a lifetime, a third reason that's more practical and more down to where we live. Now, and I got to lay a groundwork to get to the third principle, okay, right? So you see, here it is. When you are thinking about getting married, and then when you actually get married, all of us, and this isn't wrong, this is just reality, all of us enter marriage with certain desires. We have dreams and we have wishes and desires. Certain desires of what we think a loving relationship looks like. And again, that's not wrong, it just is. But many of our dreams and wishes and desires, they have come from what we experienced growing up or what we've seen in the culture, and we have these ideas that are shaped by all that. And so we come in and like, we're going to live in this kind of house, and we're going to live close to our parents, or we're going to live away from our parents, or where are we going to spend holidays, you know, with our parents or not with our parents, or we're going to always spend holidays with my parents, and we're going to spend them with my parents, and we'll have this many kids, and my spouse will do these things because mom always did these things, or my spouse will do these things because dad always did these things, and in my dream marriage, we're going to spend all our time together. Or in my marriage, we're going to have some time alone. Or I'm going to have my friends and she's going to have her friends. And we'll have some friends together. And then we're going to have some friends that we're going to never let meet each other. And so, but we all come into marriage, you know, with desires of how my marriage will be. How everything good will get better. How everything bad will disappear. How my spouse will make all my dreams come true. How my husband will be, how my wife will be, how you'll, and guys, you come into marriage with a desire, with a dream of what your wife won't wear to bed at night, right? So like this. And the wives are like, well, I just want to be comfortable and he should love me for who I am, right? Yeah, so we all walk down the aisle with all kinds of desires and wishes and dreams, most of which are shaped by what we experienced growing up. Some things we want the same as, some things we want different from, but we all come, what we all have in common is this foundation of they are my dreams, my desires, my wishes, my needs, my hopes. I mean, what else can I desire except what is personal to me, right? I mean, a little secret, it's very easy for me to be me. Now, I didn't see anybody writing that down. But it's very easy for me to be me. It's very easy for you to be you. We come into marriage with different personalities, different likes, different dislikes, different home environments and backgrounds. And so it's very easy for me to be me. It's very easy for you to be you. I mean, never once have you woken up in the morning and gone into the bathroom and looked at yourself in the mirror, had to psych yourself up for the day by looking in the mirror and looking at yourself and saying, okay, Charlie, today, remember, be me, be me, be me, be me, be me. No, you never have to psych yourself up because being me comes natural to me. I just think that being me ought to come natural to Karen, which it doesn't. Which it doesn't, because she isn't me, and your spouse isn't you. Profound stuff. So what happens is after a while, maybe a couple years, or maybe after a couple months, or maybe even after a couple weeks, or maybe on your honeymoon, you find out that the dreams that you had are going to be unfulfilled. They're not being fulfilled like you thought they would, and eventually what happens is you begin to transform those desires into something else. You begin to transform those desires into a different category, and desires become expectations. And we're not sure when that happens or how that happens, but desires become expectation. And when desires become expectation, instantly, the relationship changes. And it changes because you've got two people with unfulfilled desires that have now become what they each consider rightful expectations, right? I mean, I deserve to have a husband who treats me this way. I deserve to have a wife who does these things for me. And when expectations go unmet, both of you begin to make demands on each other, right? You make demands on each other, and then what happens? Well, demands meet with resistance. And when resistance sets in, I'm not going to do for you because you're not doing for me. When resistance sets in, that kills romance, and you've lost that loving feeling. It's gone. 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 Whoa, whoa, whoa. So the third reason that staying in love for life is so difficult is when desires become expectations and expectations become demands that meet with resistance, then resistance kills romance. It's a downward spiral. And when that happens, some people just leave. He's not the husband I expected. She's not the wife that I expected. Or I'm sick of coming home with all these expectations. I never live up to those expectations. Some people just leave. But when people leave, and I know there's lots of reasons, you know, difficult situations, but what happens a lot of times is when that's the reason for leaving, then you just carry those desires and expectations and you pile them on somebody else. But maybe even more common in the church is, you know, you might stay together, but you don't stay in love. And the wife begins to pour her time and energy into her career or her kids, or the husband pours his time and energy into his job or hobbies, and then the marriage is just spiraling down. Now follow me carefully here. When desires turn into expectations and your expectations turn into demands, you move from a covenant relationship into a contract relationship. You move from a covenant relationship into a contract relationship. What do I mean by that? I mean, you move from this unconditional love relationship into a relationship, and the language of a contract relationship is not I love you, it's you owe me. You owe me my dreams and desires. You owe me my expectations. You owe me. And a debtor relationship will kill romance. It'll kill romance because you are my wife. You owe me. You are my husband. You owe me. Because when we stood at that altar, you stood there and you promised to love me and cherish me and support me and yada, yada, yada. I mean, you promised, and you made all of these vows before my parents and your parents and our families and our friends and God. I mean, you made these promises before God, so you owe me. And I know you're sitting there thinking, but am I not justified to... Why can I expect certain things from my husband? I mean, am I not justified in expecting certain things from my wife? Well, hear me. As justified as you may feel, and as justified as you may be in light of some things that you have every right to expect, when expectations turn into demands, you're in a debtor relationship, and when that happens, intimacy, trust, romance go out the window. They're gone. In a contract relationship, too, this is very important. In a contract relationship, nobody says thank you. There's no gratitude. I mean, why would there be gratitude in a contract relationship? I mean, you never got anything from your mortgage company, you know, like a perfume little letter saying, hey, thank you so much, Charlie, for sending in your mortgage payment this month. You know, I mean, you've been so faithful, and we're hoping that Chad and Christy and Callie are all doing good, and we're here encloses a gift card for you, and next month, if you'll just tell us when their birthdays are, we'll no, you don't get that from your mortgage company, because you owe, and so in a contract marriage, then basically, you know, you do something, and your wife goes, You want thanks for that? I mean, you're just doing what I expect you to do, right? I mean, you're just doing what you should do as a wife. You're just doing what you should do as a husband, and so there's no gratitude, and then consequently, the acts of service begin to drop off because I'm not doing for him if he's not doing for me, right? So you see, and then listen, all kinds of terrible things come out of this kind of unhappiness. I mean, cold indifference and angry outbursts and affairs and addiction to porn and alcohol and drugs and sexual addiction. And listen, if you're trapped in any of that stuff, please, please, please get help. And if you contact us, we'll help you get help. But don't stay trapped in those kinds of things. But I think I've spent a lot of time on the introduction of this, but I want you to understand that there's a whole lot of things that are working against our marriages, and I don't even have time to get into the spiritual warfare that's going on because Satan has you in his crosshairs, and he wants to ruin the image of God reflected in you, and so he's doing everything he can to turn those desires into demands and to take your marriage down. And you've said this when things got rough in your marriage. Marriage just shouldn't be this hard. Like, who told you that? Who told you marriage shouldn't be hard? It is hard. It is hard. But it is possible to stay in love for life. And that's the good news of the gospel, and Jesus tells us how. Now, so, is it possible to stay in love for life? Absolutely. The Bible says so. Jesus says so. And so to answer that question, what we're going to do is I'm going to look at one verse that has a very general makes a very general statement, and then I'm going to look at a very specific application of what Jesus taught, okay? General statement, very specific application of what Jesus taught. I'm in one verse, John 13:34. Don't hardly ever do this, but I'm going to do it this morning. One verse, John 13:34. John, about two-thirds of the way through your Bible, New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, or you can find it in the table of contents on your smartphone, Bible, or tablet. 2,000 years ago, Jesus gives us, I think, the foundation for a lasting, loving relationship, and it is so simple, but it is counterintuitive. It goes against everything we think, everything we've heard, everything we believe. But it is so profound that you're going to, when I say it, you're going to say, that's it? I mean, that's it? I'm not interested in platitudes here. Look, I knew we were going to be talking about marriage this morning. I got my husband here, Charlie, so you tell him what he needs to hear, all right? I mean, don't give us this platitude business. Look, this is a life-changing truth for both of you, for me, for all of us. So here it is. Life-changing, John 13:34, a new commandment I give to you. Now, Jesus is saying to his disciples, you got the 10, you got 10 big ones, and you got 613 other ones that flesh out the 10, but I'm going to give you a new one. Now, you've kind of heard it before, but it's going to be a new and better version of the old love your neighbor as yourself kind of thing. All right, so that's what he's saying here. He says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. He's like, that's it, Charlie? I mean, Charlie, man, you should have studied harder. Is that it? Look at what Jesus does here. Jesus takes a word that we normally use as a noun, and he turns it into a verb. Love one another. That's an imperative. It's a command. He says, I'm not talking about falling in love, noun. I'm not talking about being in love, noun. I'm talking about actively doing love, verb. Now, I don't mean this with any kind of disrespect, but I don't think if you went to Jesus for counseling, you would find him to be a good counselor. I mean, because what you would do is you'd come in and Jesus would be sitting there in a chair, counselor Jesus, and you would say, Jesus, my wife, she does this and she does this and the way she spends money. And then you know, she would say, but Jesus, he won't do this. I mean, I've asked him and asked him and asked him. He won't do this. And Jesus would look at both of you and he would say, are you loving him? Are you loving her? Well, of course I love him. That's not the issue. No, that is the issue. That is the, well, we used to love each other. Well, no, you're confusing noun and verb. You used to is noun. What are you doing now to show love? And here's what he would say, here's what I want you to do. I'm gonna fix your relationship, and I want you to go home, and I want you to love each other. But we don't love each other. Well, you should, because you're married, all right? All right, well, thank you. I mean, he would try to get you to see that you're confusing love the noun with love the verb. He would say, you're saying you don't feel in love, and I do want you to feel it, but you got to do it in order to feel it, because you see, when your relationship started off, you were doing things that were creating loving feelings. You were putting his interest above your own. You were making what's important to you important to her. You were doing all kinds of things. You were trying to satisfy the desires of that other person, and you didn't realize it, but part of falling in love and being in love early on was that you were doing the kinds of things that were creating the loving feeling. So Jesus is saying, if you want to maintain love, if you want to stay in love, feel in love, you need to quit thinking of love like a noun and think of it like a verb. I want you to go home and actively love one another. See you next week. That's the way it would go. So here it is. The foundation for staying in love is to make love. Pause. A verb. Now you'll remember it, right? So let's say that together, because it's fun to say in church, all right? The foundation, say it, the foundation for staying in love is to make love a verb. You see, in your relationship, the feeling is the caboose of the train. Now, I understand that when you first got together, the feeling of love was the engine, but over time, everybody knows this, everybody says this, the love becomes the caboose. It's got to have something stronger to be the engine. And so, now, listen, feelings are important. I'm going to tell you this, and I don't want you to tell anybody else, because I don't want this to leave this room. All right? So here it is. The more you make love a verb, the more you'll make love. But you didn't hear that from me, all right? So anyway, Jesus is saying, I want you to learn how to actively love one another. Love is a verb. It's something you do. Listen, at some point in your life, this is true for everybody, two people who have been in love, there's going to be a point where you have been in love and you're not going to feel in love. And when that happens to you, you need to do the things that lovers do. Like when you first fell in love, you put the other person's interests ahead of your own. You put their desire, you work hard to satisfy their desires. You did this. You made what was important to them important to you. You did these kinds of things. And the fact is, when you do loving things, you have loving feelings. Love is a verb. To stay in love, make love a verb. Now, but Jesus doesn't stop there. Notice what he says. He says, a new commandment I give to you, love one another. Now here's the new part, because the Old Testament commanded, love your neighbor, but here's the gospel part. A new commandment I give to you, love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. Just as I have loved you, you're to love one another. That's gospel. He says, I don't want you to take your cues from the culture. I don't want you to take your cues from the movies and the media. I don't want you to take your cues even from your parents. Maybe as good as that home was, that's not where you get your cue for lasting love. Where you get your cue from lasting love, you look at me. You look at how I loved you by going to the cross and dying for you. You look at how I loved you, past tense, and you look at how I love you, present tense, because there's nothing that you can do that'll separate my love from you. And he says, if you let me, I will teach you how to love unconditionally. That's the way he loves us. He will teach us not how to be in love, but he will teach us how to stay in love. And you stay in love, and to stay in love, you have to learn to make love a verb. And so now the question though is, so what does that really look like? What does it really look like? And years later, the Apostle Paul comes along, and he basically says the same thing that Jesus said, but he uses a different word. And a lot of people consider it a bad word. It's an offensive word because of the way it has been used in different Christian circles through the years, which is a shame to take a great word like this and distort it. But the Apostle Paul takes what Jesus says in John 13:34, and he says the same thing in a different way. It's a word that sticks a little harder, has a little barb in it, but I'm telling you, it's an extraordinary word that helps illustrate what Jesus said when he said, love, verb, one another, as I have loved you, and is found in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 21. He starts right off the bat with the bad word, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Now, you know what that means. It's the same thing as love one another, except, like I said, it has a barb in it. And here's what it means. Love becomes a verb when two people submit to one another. That's mutual submission. Now, I know mutual submission is a bad word in some Christian circles because it's front-loaded with all kinds of theological baggage, but when I look at these words on this page, when I see them laying on the page, would you not agree with me that Ephesians 5:21 says submit to one another? I mean, that's pretty clear to me. That means I submit to you and you submit to me out of reverence for Christ. I submit to you. I make what's important to you important to me. You do the same. That's mutual submission. I put my interest above yours. I put your desires above mine. It's you first. No, you first. You first. No, you first. You never decide who goes, which restaurant you're going to go to. You know, like, it's deference. It's deference. Now, Paul said the same thing in Philippians chapter 2 verse 4, and Matt Dinsky read this a couple weeks ago, but it bears looking at again. Paul says, let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. That's mutual submission. And here's the Jesus part in verse 5. He says, have this mindset in your relationships with one another. Have the same mindset of Christ. What is the mindset of Christ? How did Jesus love you? By putting your interest above his own, by submitting his will to the Father's will and going to the cross for our greater good. You see in this, he's saying to stay in love, you have to make love a verb, and what that looks like in practice is learning, and it's learning. We never get this right. All of these things, we have to keep bringing the gospel to bear over and over and over again. We keep chipping away at it. But to stay in love, you have to make love a verb. And what that looks like in practice is learning to submit to one another by putting your spouse's interests above your own, because that is how Jesus' love has come to us. Now, back to Ephesians 5. Right after he says submit to one another, he goes on to specifically apply this to marriage, all right? Now, let me just say this right up front. In marriage, you have two equal people who have two different roles, and they express active love and submission in different ways, okay? But it's almost the same thing. He just says it different ways. Now, obviously, I could spend weeks going through Ephesians 5, 22 to 33, but I'm making one simple point, so I'm going to dip into this passage to make one simple point and to apply it specifically. What is my one point? My one point is to stay in love, you have to make love a verb, and what making love a verb looks like is learning to submit to one another out of reverence for Christ, out of his desire to love unconditionally, just like Jesus loved you. That's my one point. Now, so he says, verse 22, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. As to the Lord. That's the gospel part. See, automatically we're like, ooh, wives, submit. I mean, that's terrible. Look, this is what he's saying. This is what he's saying. This is my paraphrase. Wives, put your husband's interests ahead of your own by submitting, by coming under him to support him and to honor him. Honor him. He's not worth honoring. No. Why do you honor? Verse 23, because the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Head. Oh, I hate that word too. No, head doesn't mean that your husband is superior to you. Head is not a matter of rank. It is a matter. You have two equal people. It's not a matter of rank. It's a matter of responsibility. It is a matter of accountability. To say the husband is the head of the wife means that it is his head on the line because he has to give an account for the family. All right, so you submit, you come under to support him because he is going to have to give an account before God for how he led his family. So, verse 24, now as the church submits to Christ, puts itself under Christ to hold up the honor of Christ, so wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Verse 25, now husbands, one verse that tells wives to put their husband's interest ahead of their own. Nine verses talking to husbands about how they should love their wives, all right? So here's what he says. Now, everything that comes next. Oh, he said, husbands, love your wife. Here's gospel. As Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Gave himself. Isn't that a form of submission? Putting us, our interest above his own. Submitting to the will of the Father. Now, I can't go into this into detail, but everything that comes next talks about how a husband leads in the home. That he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in all splendor without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In other words, bottom line of all that is that a husband is to be committed to his wife's spiritual well-being. All right? Verse 28, in the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, gospel, because we're members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound. And I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. So, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see to it that she respects her husband. Okay, got to wrap this up. Summary. Let me summarize. Point one, to stay in love, you got to make love a verb, all right? Practically speaking, you make love a verb by submitting to each other, putting the other person's interests, desires above your own. In marriage, wives do that. Wives actively love their husbands by submitting to them, by coming under them to support them and encourage them to be spiritual leaders in the home. Husbands are to actively love their wives and submit. Well, he doesn't use that word because he uses a stronger word with a stronger barb in it. Husbands, actively love your wife by sacrificing your interest for her interest, for the good of your wife, just as Christ gave up self-interest for our good. You see. So for a wife, making love a verb means submitting to and supporting your husband. For a husband, making love a verb means sacrificing and cherishing your wife. You see it? Make love a verb. That's mutual submission. It means that we're both saying you're the priority in the relationship. What matters to you does matter to me. I want to learn how to put your interest ahead of mine. And so to stay in love, you've got to make love a verb by submitting to one another, by putting the interests of the other above your own. That's what he's saying. Now, I want you to imagine, just kind of dream with me, but what if we were able to have our desires but keep them from becoming demanding expectations? I mean, imagine in a marriage where, being in a marriage where you're doing everything in your power to put your spouse's interest above your own. A marriage where you come home at the end every day and you don't live under this tremendous weight of expectation, but it's imagine a marriage where you both enjoy loving each other the way that you loved each other at the beginning, and that is making what's important to you important to the other person. Imagine a marriage like that. I'm not saying you give up all your desires and your expectations. That's not Christianity. That's Buddhism. Buddhism says get rid of all desire because desire is the root of all misery. You hold on to your desires, but you hold them out to God. And you pray about God, those desires, and one, you check them to see if these are really the desires that God wants for you. But you pray about those desires, and you talk about your desires with your spouse, and you pray about them together, but the bottom line is you enjoy putting the other ahead of yourself. Now, I know that sounds unreal. I know it sounds crazy, but this is the gospel. I mean, is this not what the Bible says? Am I just making this up? It sounds unreal, but this is what we want, right? This is what we want, and it's what God wants for us. Now, again, hear me. Even after 40 years, I still got a long way to go. I still got a long way to go. I am a work in progress, and Karen knows that. And because she knows that, I know that. But I do know the path, because my Bible tells me the path. Because of what my Bible tells me, I know it's possible for two people to stay in love for life when those two people make love a verb. And love becomes a verb when you put the other person's interest ahead of your own. And that can be scary because it may not be returned. Now, let me tell you this. Do not go out of this room this morning with Bible bullets. So the first time your spouse messes up, you go, "You didn't hear a thing that Charlie said this morning, did you?" Because what did you do? You have a desire, now it's become a demand. But don't go out of here and do that this morning. The Bible tells us there is a path, and that path is to make love a verb by putting the other person's interest ahead of your own. And you know what the Bible calls that? Calls it a mystery that actually reflects the reality of Jesus in our life.